Part 2. Departures. A view from the pre-titles. Emotional baggage. The image is unsteady, colourful. A young girl looks at us. She is Caucasian. Blonde hair, blue eyes. Hitler would have been thrilled. We feel an uber surge of maxi relief. This isn't going to be some worthy, virtue-signaling film about social issues / justice. This is the opening frame of a Super 8 montage. This is going to be a normal, nostalgic film about attractive white people who get everything they want. The girl is a child actress called Chelsea Cole. Cole smiles, but the smile doesn't convince. It's thin, and not just because you suspect that the director, off-camera, is shouting, "Chelsea, is there any way you can make the smile a little less thin?" There's something else. Perhaps Cole already knows that this, the part of young Donna, will be her best role. Post-top, she will only manage to put in a playful performance as Poinsettia in 2003's fantasy dramedy, A Light in the Forest, before giving her swan song as young Jennifer in Vin Kreis's sensitive 2005 psychological horror dramedy, Slaughterhouse of the Rising Sun. Just a trivia note on the film, A Light in the Forest. Old Jennifer, credited just as Jennifer, is played by Cheryl Dent, whom you will recall from the 2006 dramedy Getting It, a post-American Pie boner movie in which a teenage boy is falsely rumoured to have an atypically large sex organ. The film explores the comic and poignant ramifications of this misunderstanding. It's another sensitively handled piece about the urge to connect. But before we can dwell on why Cole quit this business called show, young Donna places an eye mask over her own face. Is it a coincidence that the mask looks very much like the sleep mask we might place over our own broken faces on long-haul flights or if we're losing an argument? Is this girl, like we the audience, about to enter a dreamscape, a land of unconscious flight? Like Gloucester from King Lear, will she see better without eyes, or will she lose her way? The camera pulls back to reveal that young Donna is surrounded by four other children of similar age. They hesitantly start to spin young Donna around, as per their childminder's instructions. It would seem that this is the precursor to a popular child's game, like Pin the Tail on the Donkey. But look closer. There is no board. There is no donkey. There is no tail. Endlessly spinning the blindfolded young Donna is the game. These children have nothing to do except rotate. The thought appalls. How long will this hazing ritual last? A non-diegetic intrusion. A voice. Female. She says, "Every story has to start somewhere." Fair enough. No argument with that. It's a bloody reasonable thing to say. In fact, throughout what follows, the film sustained masterful use of first-person narration obviates the needs for potentially protracted scenes in which important character motivation might be revealed visually. Instead, the narrator, old Donna, or, as she is credited, Donna, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, simply tells us what subtext, if any, is not revealed by cutaways of signs in newspapers, expository flashbacks, and the cast's often varied facial expressions. If something about a character's motivation or a particular incident is unclear, don't worry. Old Donna will explain what's going on. This is brutally direct filmmaking, and I welcome it. If Orson Welles had had this gift, by the way, Citizen Kane might still be remembered today. He could have clarified that weird ending with a simple line of VO, saying something like, "And that's when I, Citizen Kane, realised how much I love sleds." Then, with characteristic confidence, director Bruno Barreto cuts to a banner saying, "Happy birthday." How refreshing that he trusts us to put two and two together. Like Lubitsch before him, Barreto makes his audience work for their fun. Whose birthday is it? We will have to wait to find out. This is drama. Expectation versus the controlled release of information. A wrestling match I'd pay to see. Sensing our disorientation, old Donna, in her thorough and continuing voiceover, tells us we're in Silver Springs, Nevada. Up until 1940, Nevada was the least populated state in America, and as dry as your mama's tongue, until its libertarian laws, which relaxed restrictions on prostitution, gambling, liquor, and divorce, saw the population and the flourishing of its heart increase concomitantly. We are then both told and shown, an in-camera rebuff to the moronic maxim show don't tell, it's show and tell, and we know this from school. If you show and don't tell, your teachers do not hail your visual virtuosity, they mention the lapse in your daybook. That Donna's mom, Robin Peterson, is an ex-showgirl, emphasis on the ex, so presumably she's really, really stopped being a showgirl, while young Donna's father, name unknown, actor uncredited, is only there for the beer. However, the mise-en-scène makes it look like the father has brought his own brew. If he has, and the film does not dwell on this moment, his presence could not be causally linked to the presence of the Cold Gold beer. Perhaps he could consume that can in a car park of his own choosing. If loudmouth juice, beer, was indeed provided, it begs the question of why Donna's mom, seemingly estranged from this uncredited actor, would allot any limited funds, supposedly for kids' party items, streamers, balloons, etc., to the good stuff, beer. Perhaps there were some suds, beer, for attending adults, but then why is the father being uniquely vilified? If the implication is that Donna's mom is dropping dollar money on neck oil, beer, rather than necessary party items, perhaps it is she who should be held to account. Thus, we have a work that is near ceaseless in its capacity to provoke, throwing up question after question, urging us to begin a dialogue with the film in its first few frames. This is a narrative that will resist easy or even logical answers. For example, when it's left to work out which friend slash family member is shooting and editing all this costly Super 8 film footage, given the fact that Donna's mom can only afford to live in a trailer. Barreto then treats us to an artful top shot of a small table holding up a birthday cake, like some kind of trestle atlas. Again, Barreto trusts us to fill in the gaps. Someone must have placed that cake on the table since it was brought out of the trailer by Donna's mom in shot 3. But who? Answer? It doesn't matter. That's why Barreto didn't show it. The cake is a four-candler. Yet, young Donna looks significantly older. Perhaps her parents' poverty has led them to conserve slash hoard candles. Therefore, one candle for every 2 years? Donna equals 8? A lighter enters the frame. A female hand attempts to light one of the candles. There's a spark, but no flame. A deft foreshadowing of a failed romance to come. Lord, this onion to lay it. A widish two-shot of Donna's mom and young Donna depicts a mounting frustration on Donna's mom's face. The dialogue is suggested through gesture, the arch of an eyebrow, and, in due course, gurning. How come this lighter won't produce sufficient flame to light these candles? Donna's mom seems to be saying. And now of all times, I'm being thwarted and I don't like it. When we return to the same top shot of the birthday cake, an off-camera gust blows some napkins and paper cups through the frame. We know almost immediately that it's windy, just through image. Conclusion? Lighting these candles is going to be no picnic. And it's windy. What kind of fun can you have in wind? By way of an answer, we see Donna's mom and three other women, uncredited, forming an impromptu chorus line while singing, Happy Birthday, Donna, finally clearing up the mystery of whose birthday it is. It's young Donna's. Of that much, we can be close to certain. We are low angle, over the shoulder of an unidentified sleeveless boy. It must be windy and hot. A dejected young Donna looks at the cake. It now has 6 candles on it. This seems like a more realistic age for her. Has there been an off-camera discussion between young Donna and Donna's mom that perhaps they could stretch to another couple of candles to better reflect her actual age? A dejected young Donna holds on to a red balloon, an echo of Albert Lamorisse's 1956 multi-award-winning balloon and boy dramedy, The Red Balloon, in which a lonely youngster, estranged from his peers and family, befriends a heavily anthropomorphized inflatable. For a while, it's all hijinks and skipping, but when the crimson bladder is fatally punctured by some Parisian urchins, the indefatigable dirigible calls on his colleagues from the balloon world to form a giant cluster blimp and zeppelin this young beta male to... Well, we don't know. The film ends with a tiny squit sailing up into the sky, with no real game plan. It's all very well for the music to swell, but what kind of landing is this kid going to have? Plus, he's only in shorts. That's charming at ground level, but impractically chilly at altitude. The camera zooms into a closer shot of young Donna. She lets go of the balloon, which flies out of frame. Children are often upset when they lose a balloon, but not young Donna. She doesn't care. But note, it is a helium balloon, so some money has been spent on this party. Those things don't inflate themselves. Either Donna's mom has her own canister, or she's gone to a local toy store. Corned Mem, Palm has intersected with Donna. Loath to leave any subtext unexcavated, old Donna gives us an auditory tap on the scapula. She never got to blow out her candles. Although, why didn't they just light them inside the trailer unless it was even windier inside? But she does remember wishing to get as far away from Silver Springs as possible. So, at the tender age of either 4 or 6, depending on which insert shot of the cake we are to believe, young Donna sets her heart on international relocation. But why? Is it the lack of structure to the spinning game? Is it her fear of sudden breeze? Because that's not specific to Nevada. Try wearing a fedora in Felixstowe. I thought young Donna's party looked pretty good. There was a banner, there was a cake, people attended. That's better than my last birthday. That's better than any of my birthdays. Plus, when you're 6, who cares where you live? Children are still excited by puddles. To them, a low wall is a mountain range. They're fascinated for prolonged periods of time by bubbles. And they don't even care if they're the ones blowing the bubbles. They will chase bubbles blown by others. And you can buy children off with tiny amounts of money. They feel that £1 is sufficient compensation for the loss of a tooth. They think glitter comes from unicorns. They don't care about topography. They don't worry about the difficulty of getting glitter out of carpets. And they certainly don't care about neighbourhoods. When I was 6, I didn't even know it was possible to be anywhere else. All I did was stay in the car. My parents were always in the car, going to places, getting out of the car at those places, and asking me to stay in the car until they got back from those places. But they needn't have asked. Where else would I go? It never occurred to me to leave the car. The only reason I wasn't still in bed was because I was told it was time to get out of bed and get in the car. As an only child, I never learnt to conspire. No one showed me how to rebel. I simply did not know how to transgress. I did everything I was told. My first words were, "Will that be all for today?" It wasn't until I was in my late teens that I realised I didn't have to wear the exact things my mother told me to. Finally, I could stop dressing like a cabin boy. I opted for a look which said, "Youth is wasted on me." Baggy corduroy, tucked in check shirts and tweed jackets. I looked like my own supply teacher. In John Milton's Fall of Man dramedy, Paradise Lost, Satan muses on his exile from heaven. "The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. What matter where, if I be still the same, and what I should be, all but less than he whom thunder hath made greater." In short, he's had a shocker, but he's trying to look on the bright side. Getting chucked out of heaven is a profound bummer. This isn't getting frozen out by Matt from Sales because you didn't invite him to your Great British Bake Off themed 40th. This is God asking you to leave his kingdom. And by all accounts, he's not a huge one for self-doubt. There is no verse saying, "And lo, God felt that, on second thoughts, he'd been a bit hasty, so he said, Adam, mate, at the end of the day, it's just a bit of fruit, it's no biggie. I felt a bit mugged off by a missus, I've been working a 6-day week, I'm a little bit tired and emotional, we're all new to this game, come back to the garden and we can thrash it out over a couple of tins." For the evil one, it's not where you are, it's who you're with. And as long as he's bouncing with his boys Belial and Beelzebub, he doesn't give a cloven hoof about the locale. Conversely, your man could be Maxin and Mustique, but if the Lord of the Flies is on the adjacent lounger, your man may as well be in a Bay of Turd, or Ibiza. Young Donna could take a leaf out of Satan's skin-bound book, try to get some perspective and stop with the sad eyes, but instead she seeks solace in the sky. The balloon lifts away and disappears. The frame widens past its Super 8 square shape to become the widescreen of our feature presentation, a change of texture and ratio as bold as anything in the woefully self-conscious Wizard of Oz or Andrei Tarkovsky's slumber party Stalker, which I thought would be a slasher film, not a challenge to my desire to remain conscious. The title comes up over a darkening sky. View from the top. A whole world has been built. A backstory has been painted in but a few brushstrokes. 60 seconds have slipped by in what seems like mere minutes. But before we press on, a little backstory of my own.